Jessica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardo. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guest in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. It's just after 6 p.m., and this is In the Motherhood for June 15th, 2022. I'm your host today, Robin Fadden. On today's show, we'll be borrowing two pieces of content from Wings, a Canadian radio show, whom we thank always for letting us air their content here in Montreal on CKUT. The first part of the show features Lema Gabawi on peacemaking and talking about women who must make places for themselves or spaces for themselves in all negotiations. So I invite you to listen to that now. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
Someone can slap you and you slap them back and think that after slapping that person is going to bring peace. No. It's just going to inflame and make that fight even bigger, because the next time the person sees you, they probably come in with a knife. And if they slice you and you slice them back, the next time they'll be coming with a gun.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Lema Bowie is the author of a book titled Mighty Be Our Powers. Since the book came out, the might of her powers was acknowledged with a Nobel Prize shared with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Tawakal Carmen. Lema brought Liberian women together to end that country's 14-year civil war. Films of the women's bold and desperate actions are part of the documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell, part of a U.S. public television series, Women, War, and Peace. In the last film of the series, Lema is seen rallying women from many African countries to help each other press for peace negotiations. Shortly before the Nobel Prize announcement, Lema Bowie was in the U.S. She gave an interview to Janie Reisner, host of Women's Voices on KZYX-FM.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate your taking time to do this, Lema.
No problem.
May I ask, why are you here?
Actually, on book tour.
Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War, right?
Yeah.
And it looks wonderful. The first question I ask my guests, because this is Women's Voices, is what part did your mother or perhaps your grandmother play in your life to help you in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, usually what I say to people is that my 101 feminism came from my grandmother. Uh-huh. And then if there's anything called the 202 feminism, that was from my mother. I'm from a family that has a very strong matriarchal lineage. The women in my family are very, very strong. And as a matter of fact, the region of Liberia that I come from, they say the women in that region are not just they say, but that's what I have seen as I've been growing up. The women are the breadwinners. They are the strong ones in that region, like most of the regions in Liberia. So that's the lineage I come from. But the other thing is that most African families can boast of having brothers who fought for them or who was around for them. We grew up in a family of all girls, five girls. Huh. My mother never had a son. So we were taught to do things like any boy in a community would do.
Wow. Well, that's certainly a work to your advantage.
Well, yes.
You know, there's many questions I want to ask, but I saw the movie Pray the Devil Back to Hell, which is so, so powerful. And your vision and your strength and daring to carry it out is so, so appealing to all of us. And of course, it worked. And many women in this country, we don't see women in this country doing things like that. It just doesn't happen.
Well, I think it does, but like our movement would not have gotten the kind of recognition it has gotten if we had not been fortunate for the makers of the documentary to have gone to Liberia at the time, heard the story, and decided this was a story worthy of media's attention.
Uh-huh.
So it's on that basis that I think it's something that people are doing every day. The one thing I tell people when they say, oh, how can we do this? How can we do that? The first question I ask is, how are people, if you look around, you have a lot of inner cities here in the U.S., and it's not a 0% success rate of children in those communities, especially with single mothers. It's not all of them that go to prison. What you see in some of those communities are some children who grow up in those inner cities without any crime record, and they go work and become good corporate executives, just like any other person who grew up in a very successful, rich neighborhood. The problem the world has is that those are not the kind of stories that are exotic to the press. What is sexy to the press is the stories of crime, death, and all of the different negative life drama. I think if people were taking up time to showcase successful single mothers who have brought up successful children into the media limelight, you will know that in different communities they have strong women as one. Two,
mm-hmm.
You have serious problems with drugs in some of these communities. In one community in Philadelphia, I heard when the women, I haven't met them, but there are plans on the way for us to meet. But these women have, after they watched the film Pray the Devil Back to Hell, they've gathered Mother Against Gun Violence or something like that, formed themselves, and they've been working over the last 2 years. And I think as part of their advocacy campaign, they've been able to shut down one or two businesses that sell guns in their communities. These are very good stories, but the problem is, how do we get them to be shown in the limelight, mm-hmm. like Pray the Devil Back to Hell? And I don't want to say women are not doing anything in this country. In different communities, in different parts, women are doing things. My other disappointment is when it comes to the America's policy on all of the different things. Granted that you've had problems with terrorism, which is very unfortunate, but I know that war and violence have never solved any problem, and I'm speaking from the perspective of a peace activist and someone who survived war. So I think sometimes I feel a bit disappointed is that a rallying call, a national call from women in America to this administration and to any other incoming administration that will no longer tolerate our sons going to war.
Yes.
In other countries, in the name of peace, because violence begets violence. There's no way you can slap someone. Someone can slap you, and you slap them back, and think that after slapping that person is going to bring peace. No. It's just going to inflame and make that fight even bigger, because the next time the person see you, they probably come in with a knife. And if they slice you and you slice them back, the next time they'll be coming with a gun. So never has violence solved any problem. So that's my disappointment at the national level, a rallying call for some of the global issues of peace.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's really what I was referring to, because, of course, I know there are women. Everyday lives of women are courageous, and they work under intolerable circumstances to support their children. But, you know, we see the decimation of the world, of the earth, of air and water and animals and all of us. And the guys at the top, life does not seem to have any meaning. It's clear that women are the answer for this. Return of the sacred feminine, which is what my life is about, must happen. In fact, I believe it is happening, but we all have to play a part in that and make that happen. I was speaking with Starhawk not too long ago on the radio, and I said, what can we do to make the shift? She said, well, we all know what to do in terms of permaculture, what to do to really heal the earth and life and bring it back. But the guys in power we can't seem to find a path to really make that happen. Do we all march in the streets? What?
I think the problem is over time, globally, women have come to accept our socialization, the way the world has taught us to believe that politics is not our issue. Politics is a man issue. So we sit on the fringes of politics and look at these men, in most instances, destroy our communities, destroy our world, and we say to ourselves, this is not my issue. This is not what I should be involved with. This is not my business. This is not, and we just go on and on and on and on. If you look at the world population, women make half of the world's population. How many women ministers and presidents do we see?
Right.
It's because we believe that our role is to give our support to the men and be in the back. But I think until we start socializing the younger generation to believe that the only way we can have a functional world is if the two that God created in this world, men and women, play very important roles in every aspect. So from the home to the community to the national, global, men being involved in the home, women being involved in the community decision-making, men and women being involved on the national stage, men and women being involved on the global stage. Because one side of the brain, if it's functioning, is not a functional body. If the two sides of the brain are functioning, that is a functional body. So the reason why we're seeing all of this is because our world is operating literally on one side of its brain. Predominantly, the men are the ones making the national and global decisions. It's time for us to step into this space. It's not enough for us to keep complaining that they're not getting us involved. We need to start creating our own spaces. We need to start voting for ourselves. We need to start making our voices loud. And that's the reason why programs like your program is very important. But then also, how many men listen to your program? As a matter of fact, how many women will be listening to your program? If you do a survey of the Colbert Report or Jon Stewart Tonight Show, you see also that a lot of women sit and listen to those programs also. How are you also charting out a course for yourself? So I think the answer to the world is not everyone getting into the streets, but everyone playing a role from the home to the local to the national, in politics, in everything. Gone are the days where we just vote for men. Now is the time for us to put ourselves into the space and get voted for.
A woman. Yes, yes. Finding that path is not easy. But knowing that you have a right to do it and an obligation to do it, to awaken to that as a woman, is very, very important. This is the moment. You know, this really is the moment, especially, I believe, for elder women, for mothers, to claim the world for their own and for their children.
Yeah.
It was in the movie, Pray the Devil Back to Hell. You saw what was happening. I'm not clear on all the sequences in your life, but I believe you were already trained as a trauma counselor. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then you had children, and there was domestic violence. Is this true?
Oh, yes. But the sequence of it was that I left that violent relationship, moved back to Liberia, and stayed in the house with my family and was able to, at some point, start doing some work. And, yes, I had this real strange dream when, and it was like someone saying, you need to bring the women together to pray for peace. I felt like, there's something definitely wrong with this dream. I am not the real candidate to be carrying this message of peace, because at that time, I had all of the wrong reasons or all the right reasons for not getting involved. I wasn't married. I was in a relationship that I wasn't married to the person, and blah, blah, blah. All of the things that our socialization teaches us, that, like I was speaking about earlier, that keeps us out of any well-meaning political space, was those issues that I was dwelling on. But I had a boss who said to me, the dream bearer is the dream carrier. So you have to. And we held hands that morning and prayed, and that was the beginning of my personal journey into something I had no idea about, called peace activism.
Wow. Well, it certainly caught on.
It did. It really did. Until today, it's still something that is really, really still doing great, not just for Liberians, but for women in other parts of Africa who have gone through conflict. They see that as an inspiration and a reason for them to get up and take stands for their communities.
Yes, yes.
On Wings, you're listening to Nobel Peace Laureate Lema Bowie, interviewed by Janie Reisner.
Yes. And the fact that you were able to, at the gathering at the palace, to keep the men there until they agreed to peace with Charles Taylor inside, was the most extraordinary event. They could have killed you, couldn't they?
Well, we met with Taylor, and then we left and went to Ghana for the peace talks. And then it was in Ghana that we had the confrontation with the men in the hall. And the men in the hall were, some of them were comrades of Taylor, but he as an individual was not in the hall at the time we seized the hall.
I see.
Whether I could have been killed during those days of protest, I never really dwelled on it, because the thing is, our life and our lives as women and children, our children's lives have been degenerated to a place where we really didn't know tomorrow wasn't certain. Yes, okay, tomorrow is not certain for anyone, but ours was blatantly staring us in the face every day in the form of overdrug child soldiers. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you're not guaranteed in next minute, you know? Every morning you woke up, you told God, thank you. You're going to bed. You went to bed with a heavy heart. You woke up with a heavy heart. That was no life to live. So it was almost like a living dead group of people. You could not plan for tomorrow. You could not plan for future. You could not plan for 6 months later. So even if your roof was leaking, you would just leave it and the water would run on you and your family every night, because nothing was certain. That was not life. So it never once crossed our minds as we did our protest that, oh, we could be killed or we could be beaten or we could be in prison. Because there's something about oppression that when you've gone through it for so long and when that thing snaps, you have no care about any kind of physical condition. So sometimes I'm sure people tend to wonder, this activist, someone like Mandela, 27 years in prison, what was going through his mind? Yeah. Nothing but freedom. And I do not want to even try to compare what we did with what Mandela did for South Africa. But I think if you think of a group of people who are going through oppression, suppression, and pain, you realize that I've gone through it. When that thing snaps, you are prepared to go for how many whatever years in torture, in suffering, in protest, as long as you are looking at an end of that suffering at some point in time. So, for example, you can find people doing hunger strike, and you have a whole generation of people, once you've started something like that, looking up to you and saying, our hope, our future lies in whatever this person or this group of individuals are doing. Yeah. So for us as women of Liberia at that point in time, people were looking at us, calling us and saying to us, please don't stop. You give us hope every day that there is a tomorrow.
You bet. Absolutely. It's so beautiful. It just does something to our hearts. It just wells up that power and the sense of rightness. That sounds so beautifully put and true. And then your book, here we are with your book that you're going around the world with. Okay, may I read just a little, the Kirkus Review?
Mm-hmm.
Searing war-torn memories from a visionary African peacekeeper and women's rights activist. Bowie stands responsible for what began as a tireless vocal demonstration and soon escalated to a standoff on the presidential mansion steps demanding peace. This course of action facilitated the war's end in 2003 and the election of Africa's first female president and ended the author's personal struggles with alcohol, which I wasn't aware of. With commanding charity, Bowie celebrates Liberia's 8 years of peace and continues teaching young women about the power of activism. A patriotic chronicle reverberant with valor and perseverance. So there you are. You're also the executive director of the Women, Peace, and Security Network, Africa, which is in Ghana.
Yes. So I tell people my official address is in Ghana, but I spend a lot of time in Liberia and other parts doing the work that I do. So I can never boast at one point in time of sleeping in my bed in Ghana for 30 days straight. No.
Wow.
It's either 5 or 7 days. Uh-huh. And then it's Liberia, it's somewhere else, it's somewhere else.
Wow.
But never 30 days at a stretch.
Mm. And you have 6 children.
I do. One of my daughters is adopted.
Uh-huh.
And I have 5 biological children and 1 adopted. But I lay claim, I tell people I lay claim to 8 children because I have a brother. My father had a son. From another relationship I took in when he was 10. He's 23 now. I have my niece. I lost my sister in 2006.
Hmm.
So I lay claim to those other 2. So I say 8 kids.
They're growing up at this point in time, I assume.
Oh, yes, they're doing very well. My brother is, as a matter of fact, he was the one I was on the phone with.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Ghana, and he's completing computer college there. My niece is in Ohio, and she's a junior at the Wright State University.
Huh.
My son is at the Eastern Mennonite University here in the U.S. He's studying digital imaging, something. I think I tell people I'm an African. I don't know a lot about these things, but... It has a lot to do with the arts of photography and computer-driven images and all of those things. And then I have a 17-year-old who's here in New York. She has a scholarship from the Catholic school, Marymount. She's a graduating senior. Then I have the rest of them. I have a 2-year-old who just started daycare on Monday. And I don't have a Facebook page. I don't do Facebook, Twitter. Because I'm not IT savvy. So she's all over her siblings' pages, and they share pictures of her going to school every day. And then my other 3, the adopted one, and my 13 and 15-year-old, they all live in Ghana with me.
You're a busy woman.
Well, you can say that, but as busy as I am, I try to do what I've been called to do. And I see the work I do as a calling.
Of course. I saw a film clip on a video on the computer in which you were sitting on a board, I believe, and I think this was in 2006, but you were talking about a measure.
The UN Security Council Resolution 1325.
Exactly.
On women, peace, and security. And I think that... resolution is something that drives a lot of work that women's rights activists do around the world now. The resolution was passed by the UN 2001 by the UN Security Council. So, and that resolution calls for the involvement of women every stages
right.
or in every stage of conflict, mediation, conflict negotiation, conflict transformation in communities coming out of conflict. And most of the time, our frustration as people who do the kind of work that we do is how communities or people who negotiate peace in these different conflicts tend to forget that it's not just the warmongers, those who bring the war, that are able to end the war. But even those who are affected by the wars, and 100% of the time, those affected by the wars are the women and children, specifically the women, are the ones who are able to end the wars. They have some of the answers for ending their conflict in their hands. So a lot of our advocacy now is around Resolution 1325. Because if you look at mediation efforts for global conflicts around the world, you rarely find women as mediators. So we're saying we have smart women, and so we need women to be involved. One of the theories or principles that I know is that once the whole process of negotiating the end of conflict starts and women are left out from that initial phase, that is the beginning of the marginalization of women. Everything that has to do with post-conflict reconstruction, post-conflict development, and everything leading to the rebuilding of the nation. And then also just reinforcing the status quo of women's discrimination against women, and you know all of those former culture of violence and not involving women. So we advocate for from the get go. By the time communities start talking about we need to end this war, that first question of how do we end the war, as you're engaging with the fighters, as you're engaging with the warlords, let the women be involved in the conversation.
Absolutely, and they still aren't. Isn't that
no.
true?
even after the UN kind of like instituted or passed this resolution, the first ever resolution clearly stating women's involvement in peace and security issue, we're still having that struggle to deal, which is really ironical.
Well, I guess it really shows how little the men who are running it care about including women. And in fact, if they can get by without it, they do. You know, I was speaking with someone from Madre regarding Haiti and trying to put that back together. And the violence against women continues, and they don't include women and that was
never,
their...
Never. It's like, you know, everyone will be doing something and say, oh, we have to do this. And once it comes to women's issues, then they have a serious case of amnesia.
Yeah, they
yeah.
do. So that's how can we? That's the question. How do
well,
overcome
the question,
this?
The question or the thing now is sustain advocacy on the roles, the needs, priorities, and concerns of women during and after conflict. That's one. Two. Going back to my former point, we need to step up.
Yep.
Because there was a report done by Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's now president of Liberia, and Elizabeth Rand, and the report is called Women, War, and Peace. And this report was done as a result of the early conflicts in the 90s, the civil wars that were happening in different countries. But there was a quote from those two women. They said, during conflict, the impact of the wars on women is a reflection of the interactions during peacetime. So in conflicts, in countries where you have issues of rape and abuse during conflict, go back to those countries and check the history of the interaction of men and women in peacetime, and check if you have statistics on issues of domestic violence. You will find a huge surge in those numbers, because if communities ignore the needs and concerns and priorities of women in peacetime, what do you think they will do when there's chaos?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. May we all take that to heart. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your very busy life, and I hope that your book, Mighty Be Our Powers, comes into everybody's consciousness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No problem, Pop.
And many blessings to you and all your work.
Amen. Thank you. Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Shortly after this interview, Lema Bowie was announced as a Nobel Peace Laureate. The interview was conducted by Janie Reisner, host of Women's Voices on KZYX-FM in Philo, California, and edited for Wings by Bea Bernhausen.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and this is In the Motherhood. Coming up next is another piece borrowed from Wings, and it's about gender in action, and it takes a deep look at the long-term process of making the world's parliaments and legislatures gender equitable, gender sensitive, and diverse. This is based on a three-part series from Rabble Radio interviews, and we thank Rabble and we thank Wings for letting us borrow it here on CKUT. Thanks for listening.
Today on Wings.
Can you really say a democracy is healthy if its parliamentary institutions members are so unrepresentative of the people they're supposed to be representing?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. The movement to increase women's representation in governing bodies has been at work for generations, and some progress has been made. But the Interparliamentary Union, which tracks national statistics for 193 countries, said in 2021 that progress had essentially stagnated. As of March 1, 2022, only 5 countries had 50% women or more in their lower house of Congress or Parliament: Rwanda, Cuba, Nicaragua, Mexico, and the United Arab Emirates. The UK was in 45th place for percentage of women in its parliament, Australia 57th place, and Canada ranked 59th. Why? Canadian political scientist Dr. Jeanette Ash is a specialist in this question. After Canada's 2021 federal election, Ash appeared in a series of podcasts for Rabble Radio with interviewer Libby Davies, herself recently retired from Parliament as deputy leader of Canada's new Democratic Party.
Thank you so much for joining me, Jeanette Ash. I know that you're the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College. You're well published. You do a lot of research about how we're doing in terms of gender representation in the political arena, but also diversity overall in Canada's Parliament. And I thought we could begin by reflecting on the recent federal election. There's 103 women who were elected to the House of Commons, so we finally hit the 30% representation of the whole parliament, up slightly from 29% from the 2019 election. And of the 49 new members of parliament, 22 are women.
So up from 29% to 30% women. The election before that, it was 2015. What was the percentage? 26%. The election before that, it was 25%. So over the last 4 elections or so, we've only seen an increase of a few percentage points.
So those are the numbers. But of course, what's interesting is what is behind the numbers.
There is a myth that women and other equity deserving groups don't come forward. You know, they don't seek candidacy. So there's a real blame placed on the underrepresented group. But if you really look at it closely, you have to look at the gatekeepers to the corridors of power. So the gatekeepers to office in a parliamentary system like Canada, where parties are so strong, are the parties. So it's the parties' selection processes that are really keeping equity-deserving groups like women and like people who identify as Indigenous or Black or people of color or LGBTQ as plus out of those powerful positions. So a lot of the research that I've done focuses on this and works to dispel that myth that blames the underrepresented group. So if you look at all of the people who actually apply to become a candidate for a political party, and then you look at the people who are actually selected by party members as the official candidate to stand in the election, you'll see that they don't really match up. There's a disproportional number of men getting through compared to women. And this is especially the case in winnable seats. So in parties' target seats and parties' winnable seats. So we might have record number of women standing for office. We see parties putting in more effort to recruit women. So that is good. But we really, really haven't seen a huge improvement, especially in terms of being elected.
Do you see it primarily as a party allowing systemic barriers and obstacles to stay in place, the status quo, the old, you know, the old boys club?
So if you pull back the curtains on party selection processes, where we do see women getting selected, they're not getting selected at the same rates in winnable or target seats as men. And one of the reasons for this is party members can only choose one candidate to represent their party in an electoral district. And by default, they often will select the person that most resembles who has historically been successful in the past. And of course, if you look at our parliaments, they historically comprised, initially 100% of white, professional, straight men. So they think, okay, we have one chance at getting our candidate elected. So we ought to choose the person who most looks like the successful politician, the sort of standard model candidate. And so that's what they tend to do. And I've done studies where with everything held equal, so women and men having the same kinds of political experience, education levels, all that kind of thing, party members are up to 5 times more likely to choose a man in a winnable seat or a safe seat over a woman or than a woman. And that's quite striking. And to me, that says that's an institutional bias at the party level where party members are probably not even aware that they're doing this.
For the women who are running, is part of the barrier the response of the electorate?
There's been research that shows that the electorate does not discriminate against women candidates. In fact, there's a slight bias towards women candidates, and some parties in some countries have clued into this, and they see, okay, there might actually be an electoral advantage to selecting more women in target and winnable seats because the electorate actually likes them. So this is a real, it's kind of a wake-up call, I think, and we really have to address this. One way is to formally encourage parties. You can incentivize parties, or you could penalize parties for not selecting a certain percentage of women or people from other equity deserving groups. And this could be in the form of a sex quota where you create an artificial demand temporarily. So we do get that boost in the percentage.
Has that been done anywhere?
In Canada, where we see that is in British Columbia. The BC legislature, the BC New Democratic Party, has had in place an equity mandate for several years, and that has resulted in the BC NDP having a caucus that is a majority women. There was initially a lot of resistance to the equity mandate, but now the results are celebrated, and the policy itself is celebrated too. And in New Brunswick recently has in place a policy to incentivize parties to select more women candidates as well, but other than that, there's no formal measures in place to ensure parties select 50% women candidates in safe seats. There was an attempt federally, Bill 237, the Gender Equity Elections Canada Act, that was proposed. It was a private member's bill by Kennedy Stewart, which I worked on, and alongside me, many, many academics from across Canada and in Ireland and in the UK. So we had a lot of organizations behind this, and this bill did fail, and the bill has been successful in other countries, like a similar type of policy has been successful in Ireland and in France, for example. And it it's not a quota, but what it does is it encourages parties to select more women and people from equity-deserving groups. If they do, then they won't lose some of their public subsidy because parties are publicly subsidized. You know.
I'd like to continue our conversation by hearing more about the research you have completed and the research that's still underway. I know you've looked at the BC legislature and how to make it gender sensitive. What does that mean, gender sensitive?
It's multifaceted, but some of the criteria include the following. A gender sensitive parliament is a place that promotes and achieves equality in the numbers of women and men across all of its bodies and internal structures. And when I say women, I'm also including, you know, people who identify as women. So I'm considering intersectionality as well. A gender-sensitive parliament mainstreams gender equality through all of its work. A gender-sensitive parliament fosters an internal culture that respects women's rights and promotes gender equality. It is a place that respects the needs and realities for balance, work-life balance, family responsibilities for men and women. And a gender-sensitive parliament is one that extends beyond members. It also considers parliamentary staff, legislative staff, and equips them with the capacity and resources needed to promote gender equality, recruiting, and also having retention of women in senior positions. So those are some of the criteria from the Interparliamentary Union, which does a lot of work on gender sensitizing parliaments. And there are actually more criteria, but these are just some. Parliaments are workplaces for members, but also for many, many staff, so parliamentary, legislative staff, party staff. So when we're thinking of these places, we've got to think of them as places of work. And what should a place of work be like? What is a place of work that is gender sensitive and diversity sensitive? A place where people go and where they feel welcome, where they feel like they belong, where they feel safe, where they feel they can equally participate. I've done a little bit of work on this with the BC legislature initially. I've used the BC legislature as a case study, and it's the first of its kind in Canada. And there's many phases to a gender-sensitive assessment. So I've started the first few steps in BC and published a report. It's online. It's called Assessing Gender and Diversity Sensitivity at the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia. And this report was prepared for the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians Canadian region. So you can find that online, and you can find more details about what a gender-sensitive parliament is, what it looks like, and some of my initial findings. So one of the steps of a gender-sensitive parliament that I did do in BC is to get the clerk's office to fill out a checklist to determine how ready a parliament, a legislature, is to undertake a gender-sensitive assessment, because it is a big undertaking. And so you have to find out if they have the kind of data that are required to do a gender-sensitive assessment. And if you go to the report that you can find online, you'll see that there's 68 initial questions that were filled in by the clerk's office. And of those 68 questions, they only were collecting data on 11 of the kinds of things that you needed data on. So they don't really collect data on things like representation on committees, or there's no requirement, for example, for the legislature to debate the importance of gender diversity at all. So there's a lot of room for improvement. Now, I should say that BC comparatively isn't doing badly. I mean, 43% of the legislators in BC are women. There's one party, the BCNDP, that has over 50% of women in its caucus. It's a very diverse legislature, more diverse than it's ever been. The head clerk is a woman, Kate Ryan Lloyd. The speaker, Raj Johan, for example, is from an equity-deserving group. And so there's been lots of steps towards gender sensitivity. They're undertaking a workplace review. But again, there's a lot of room for improvement.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from the podcast series Rabble Radio. Here's Brianne Doyle, who is managing editor of the media outlet Rabble.ca and the producer of Rabble Radio, with more about the interviewee and the interviewer featured in our program today.
Dr. Jeanette Ash is the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College. She's also a visiting faculty member at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, King's College London. Her research interests include political recruitment, political parties, representation, and gender in politics. She is the author of Political Candidate Selection, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Underrepresentation in the UK. Other recent publications include Gender Sensitivity Under Trudeau, Facebook Feminism or Real Change, and Canada's Political Parties, Gatekeepers to Parliament. Dr. Ash advises legislatures, parties, and organizations on assessing gender and diversity sensitivity. She also advises legislators on drafting legislation on gender equity and democratic reform. Libby Davies is the author of Outside In, a Political Memoir. She served as the MP for Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015 and is former NDP Deputy Leader and House Leader. Libby is also the recipient of the Order of Canada.
Welcome back, Jeanette.
I'd like to continue our conversation by hearing what you recommend to make the BC legislature gender sensitive.
I've been undertaking ongoing interviews with the staff and members there. And when we think about people, when they get elected to a place, we have to consider what happens to them. And I'm hearing a lot of things that reflect what members of other legislatures are saying. Like the heckling is a problem. A lot of women feel that they don't really belong there. They don't feel welcome. So a lot of women are reporting that they're not getting promoted at the same rates as men. But again, we need the data, the diversity data on this. Some women are reporting that they don't feel safe places. Some report that the rules are really archaic and old, and they reflect the legislature as it was when it was built. It was a place that was built by men, for men, and not a lot of the institutional features of the place have changed. So it's still very much like a masculine place with a masculine culture. And, you know, this is kind of embedded in its practices and its rules. So when we talk about a gender-sensitive parliament, we have to talk about identifying what those gender-insensitive rules are, those gender-insensitive practices are, the sort of masculine cultural features of it. And we've got to change those, and we have to institutionalize those changes. So it's not just about informally doing things differently. It's about implementing these changes. And it shouldn't be done just by a few champions of gender diversity. So it's not the responsibility of, you know, the parliamentary secretary for gender equity. It's not the responsibility of a handful of women in the Women's Caucus. It's the responsibility of everybody there. It's all members and staff and parliament or the legislatures itself. Like, it has to be institutionally changed.
That tells us how complex this work is. So I'd like to move beyond the BC legislature, which, as you said, was a case study, because I know you're also doing work at the national level with MPs and staff. What have you learned from that? And particularly the issue of the hybrid parliament that we've seen in the last couple of years.
So the case study of the BC legislature, that kind of paved way for doing a larger assessment, a more fulsome assessment through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. And I've been asked now to look at the national legislature, so the House of Commons and the Senate, and parliaments, legislatures across Canada. So I'm undertaking the next steps of the BC legislature gender sensitivity parliamentary review, in addition to focusing on Manitoba and Quebec and Prince Edward Island, and as I said, the National House of Commons and the Senate. I'm finding some very interesting things. This is ongoing, this work. So I'm interviewing members, and there's also a survey that's been sent out. I'm getting responses now. Some of the feedback that I've been getting amongst women anyways is the impact that things like heckling, so verbal harassment, it has on them. This is something that I'm seeing in all the legislatures. And if they complain that heckling is really upsetting, they're told, you know, to toughen up, that this is part of politics and this is what they should expect. But this is the very thing that indicates a parliament is not a gender sensitive place. So to be told that heckling is a part of it, to expect heckling and not to complain about heckling, is something that reinforces this really sort of toxic masculine culture in parliament. One of the things that is coming through in the surveys and the interviews that I ask about is the experiences with hybridity. So one of the things that have come out of the pandemic is parliaments across the world, including Canada, they've been disrupted. So the workplace has been disrupted, like all of our workplaces, and they've had to adapt. And one of the ways that adaptation has taken place is to move parliament online. So this allows members to participate virtually from home in terms of recorded divisions and also committee work. And there's been varied responses to this. So at the national level, they passed a bill in the fall that is allowing members of parliament to engage with hybridity so they can work from home in terms of recorded divisions or committee work, or they can work face-to-face. It's up to them. And I think that's in place until spring 2022, and it'll be revisited. Some of the provincial legislatures have also engaged with hybridity, not all of them. Some of them have, BC has as well. But what we've seen happening provincially is that it hasn't been continued. So members can still participate virtually, but they have to have a reason. They have to be ill. Otherwise, they're expected to be there. Now, nationally and in the provinces, what I've been finding is there's this real nervousness about, well, what if we'll always have to be face-to-face? And when people have experienced this staying at home and being able to vote, it's allowed them to more fully participate. And I see this especially with women and people with members with young children, staff as well, saying that the ability to vote from home, especially when they're caring for elders or for people who are ill in their family or children, for example, has allowed them to more fulsomely participate. They can vote. And there's, again, this real worry that if it's mandated that they have to go face-to-face sort of permanently, that they might not reoffer themselves. So they might not seek re-election. And this is the problem, because we have already a problem in terms of retention of women members. We see higher turnover of women members. So if we've come up with a solution to make a parliament more gender sensitive, and the technology is already there, and if it means that people are going to stay in their job, why not keep it? This is kind of a win-win situation. I want to say, though, it's not the same for all. Some people don't like it. They like the energy of being face-to-face. And one thing to consider, too, is the impact it has on staff. Some staff like it because, again, they can participate more fully if they have other responsibilities. But some staff have said that it's actually made their workload a lot more. We might be stuck inside and not able to do the work from home, but we're expected to extend our hours to serve the members. Another aspect, though, of the hybrid parliament is that I've been hearing from especially younger women members and women members who identify as Indigenous or Black, as a person of color, that it has made the experience of being a legislator safer. It's made them feel more comfortable. And one reason for this is that there is no heckling. If another member is heckling them, then they can be muted. And members are generally muted unless they're, you know, talking. So the experience of heckling has gone way down, and it's made working more pleasant. And when you think about these places as workplaces, in what other workplace is it okay to scream at your colleagues and to call them names or to undermine them? And a lot of this is really gender-based, right? There's also of course, there's no instances of face-to-face intimidation or other forms of harassment that we see, despite legislatures trying to improve upon their codes of conduct. Me Too has come to parliaments across Canada for sure. And more people are researching violence against women in politics. And in all of the interviews I've done with women, all of them have shared incidences of harassment in one way or another that they've received from other members of their legislative assemblies or members of parliament who harass them, who intimidate them, who bully them. Again, a lot of this is gender-based. It's not right. It shouldn't be taking place, but it does. The way to follow up on this is problematic as well. So the harassment policies across Canada need to still be improved.
That is an incredibly significant finding that you've come across with the hybrid parliament and the responses that you got, which leads me to my last question, really, and that is how important this research is so that we actually can get the data, get the experiences, both the objective and the subjective experiences. So how much of this work is being undertaken elsewhere? Are you on your own doing this work, or are there other parliaments in other countries looking at this kind of issue as well?
I am far from alone, and all of the work I do on this, I'm building on the work of other gender and politics scholars and researchers and other organizations. If it wasn't for the work that they've done already and that they are doing, I wouldn't be doing this work at all. This work is very, very much inspired by the work of Professor Sarah Childs, who did the real first fulsome gender sensitive assessment of the British Parliament. She did that in 2016, and you can go online and see it. It's called The Good Parliament. It's amazing. She came up with 43 recommendations of how to make the good parliament more gender sensitive. So my work very, very much builds on Sarah Child's work. And she has been incredibly supportive in the work that I've been doing in Canada and has been sort of a champion of this work and has encouraged it from the get-go. This work also builds on the work of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association and Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians, who have been doing work on women's political equality in Commonwealth countries for over 20 years. And it also builds on the work of the Interparliamentary Union, who have been doing this work for over a decade as well, and has put together a gender assessment toolkit. So you can go online and see the Interparliamentary Union's gender assessment toolkit. And this is the toolkit that the IPU encourages all parliaments to look at, and they really encourage all parliaments to undertake an internal gender parliamentary assessment review. And you can see the list of countries that have done it. Right now, I am doing some more work for the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. They have asked me to do a field guide that all Commonwealth parliaments will be encouraged to look at. And I'm just completing that right now. 7 steps to a gender-sensitive parliament. So I've come up with the 7 steps assessment, and it should be coming out soon.
That is fantastic to hear. I mean, there's just so much work that you've undertaken. And I get the sense that you are optimistic that there will be follow-up, that your work has been received very well, because of course it's resonating with the experience that all of these equity-seeking groups have. So it sounds like you're optimistic that there will be follow-up.
Oh, absolutely. Gender sensitizing parliaments undertaking assessment, or at least talking about an assessment, is becoming more of a norm now, an international norm. And parliaments look at what other parliaments are doing. One of the measures of a gender-sensitive parliament is having equal numbers of women and men in legislative bodies and also within staff, within senior positions as well. A lot of parliaments are looking at how they can work toward this. And I should say, a really important part of gender-sensitizing a parliament is to institutionalize the gender sensitivity recommendations. And this is done by assigning any recommendation to a particular person, like, for example, to a speaker. And the speaker has a good deal of authority in terms of implementing gender sensitivity recommendations. One of the things that came out of Sarah Child's The Good Parliament is proxy voting. And proxy voting is now being trialed in the UK. And it's very, very welcome indeed. For example, a woman member of parliament was scheduled to have a C-section, and she had to be present for the recorded division. I mean, there's no ifs and or buts, and she had to be there. It was a very close vote. And so she showed up for the recorded division in a wheelchair, about to have a C-section, just so she could vote. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So shortly after that, and with a lot of pressure, and this is one of many, many instances, with a lot of pressure, the British Parliament is now trialing proxy voting. So you don't have to be physically present to cast your vote. You can get somebody to act as a proxy for you. And so this, of course, has caught wind across other jurisdictions. And now Canada's national parliament is looking into proxy voting and other kinds of policy changes, small policy changes that would make a huge difference. So you don't have women showing up to vote just moments away of having a C-section and having to postpone that C-section of all things. So small things like that. There's quite a few examples, but that's one. And I think that we'll see more parliaments revisiting or looking at this in more detail.
Well, that's a very dramatic example and a very good example of why things need to change. Jeanette, we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you so much for all the information that you shared today.
Okay, thank you, Libby. And I should just say, I feel like I should be interviewing you about this.
It's a good conversation.
You were there.
It's a good conversation. Yeah.
That was Canadian political scientist Dr. Jeanette Ash, interviewed by retired member of Canada's Parliament, Libby Davies. Their remarks were excerpted from 3 episodes of the podcast series Rebel Radio, which can be found through the website rebel.ca. By the way, in case you were wondering, in the Interparliamentary Union statistics on percentages of women in the world's parliaments, the U.S. is tied for 72nd place with the Dominican Republic. Russia is 137th. Find the complete rankings at data.ipu.org. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio for a link to recent archives. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found at gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Thanks to Wings, and thank you for listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. You can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca if you have any ideas for shows, if you'd like to be on the show, or if you'd like to make any comments. And you can find us on Facebook at CKUT-InTheMotherhood. Thanks for listening. Here's a song by Krista Muir, and stay tuned to CKUT for all kinds of great music coming up.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, to another edition of Amandla, your Amandla Radio, your weekly news show on with analysis and briefings on the continent of Africa. And we have a very interesting lineup today. I'm going to talk to rebroadcast an interview I did with a trade unionist who was very active in the anti-apartheid movement with the SACTU Solidarity Committee back in the 1980s. And it's very exciting to hear somebody who's so clearly anti-imperialist and clear on what's the role of trade unions and international solidarity. So Gwen, what have you got?
Nice. Thanks, Doug. Yeah, I had a great conversation with Frederic Mousseau. He's the policy director of the Oakland Institute out in California. The Oakland Institute does a lot of on-the-ground research in collaboration with people, communities, and organizations that are confronted with land grabs, and we often turn to them for their analysis. And so this, sadly, is a story that is now 10 years old. It was back in the day, the Senegalese government declassified a nature reserve in order to lease it to an Italian-owned agribusiness company. The community has been fighting ever since, and now the news is that that company has been sold to a U.S. concern.